Part 5. Valentine Ketterly. The events of the 15th of November, 2012. I visited him in mid-November. It was just after 4, a cold, blue twilight. The afternoon had been stormy, and the lights of the cars were pixelated by rain, the pavements collaged with wet black leaves. When I got to his house, I heard music playing, a requiem. I waited for him to answer the door to an accompaniment of Berlioz. The door opened. "Dr. Ketterly," I said. He was between 50 and 60, tall and slender, a handsome man. He had an ascetic-looking head with high cheekbones and forehead. His hair and eyes were dark, and his skin was olive-coloured. His hair was receding, but only a little, and he had a neatly trimmed, slightly pointed beard with more grey in it than his hair. "Yes," he said, "and you are Matthew Rose Sorensen." I agreed that I was. "Come in," he said. I remember how the smell of rain that pervaded the streets did not die away as I entered, but somehow intensified. Inside the house there was a smell of rain, clouds, and air, a smell of limitless space, a smell of the sea, which made no sense at all in a Victorian terraced house in Battersea. He led me to a sitting room. The Berlioz was playing. He turned down the volume, but it still played in the background of our conversation, the soundtrack of catastrophe. I placed my messenger bag on the floor. He brought coffee. "You're an academic, I understand," I said. "I was an academic," he explained with a slight weariness, "until about 15 years ago. I'm in private practice as a psychologist now. Academia was never very welcoming to me. I had the wrong sort of ideas and the wrong sort of friends. I suppose the Arne Sales connection didn't do you any favours." "Well, quite. People still think I must have known about his crimes. I didn't." "Do you still see him?" I asked. "God, no. Not for 20 years. He looked at me speculatively. "Have you spoken to Lawrence?" "No. I've written to him, of course, but so far he's refused to see me." "Sounds about right." "I thought perhaps he didn't want to talk to me because he feels ashamed of the past," I said. Ketterly gave a short, sharp, humorless laugh. "Hardly. Lawrence has no shame. He's just perverse. If someone says white, he'll say black. If you say you want to see him, then he won't want to see you. That's just the way he is." I lifted my messenger bag onto my lap and fetched out my journal. As well as my current journal, I also had with me the previous volume of my journal, which I referred to almost every day, the index to my journals, and a blank notebook that would form the next volume of my journal. I was very close to the end of the current one. I opened my current journal and began to write. He watched with interest. "You use physical pen and paper?" "I use a journal system for all my notes. I find that it's much the best way for keeping track of information."
"And are you a good record keeper?" he asked. "On the whole."
"I'm an excellent record keeper."
"On the whole."
"Interesting," he said.
"Why? Do you want to offer me a job?" I asked. He laughed. "I don't know. Maybe."
He paused.
"What is it you're actually after?"
I explained that I was chiefly interested in transgressive ideas, in the people who formulate them, and how they are received by the various disciplines, religion, art, literature, science, mathematics, and so forth.
"And Lawrence Arne Sales is the transgressive thinker par excellence. He crossed so many boundaries. He wrote about magic and pretended it was science. He convinced a group of highly intelligent people that there were other worlds and he could take them there. He was gay when it was still illegal. He kidnapped a man, and to this day no one knows why."
Ketterly said nothing. His face was a discouraging blank. He looked more bored than anything.
"I realize that all this happened a long time ago," I offered, with a stab at empathy. I have an excellent memory, he said coldly. Oh, well, that's good. Just at the moment, I'm trying to build up a picture of what it was like at Manchester in the first half of the 80s, working with Arne Sales. What the atmosphere was like. What sort of things he was saying to you. What sort of possibilities he was conjuring up. That kind of thing. Yes, mused Ketterly, speaking apparently to himself. People always use words like that about Lawrence. Conjuring. You object to the word? Of course I object to the fucking word, he said irritably. You're suggesting that Lawrence was some sort of stage magician, and we were all his wide-eyed dupes. It wasn't like that at all. He liked you to argue with him. He liked you to put the rationalist point of view. And then? And then he demolished you. His theories weren't just smoke and mirrors, far from it. He thought everything through. It was perfectly coherent as far as it went, and he wasn't afraid to merge intellect with imagination. His description of the thinking of pre-modern man was more persuasive than anything else I've come across. He paused. I'm not saying that he wasn't manipulative. He was certainly that. But I thought you just said on a personal level. In his relationships, he was manipulative. On an intellectual level, he was honest. But on a personal level, he was as manipulative as hell. Take Sylvia, for example. Sylvia D'Agostino. Strange girl. Devoted to Lawrence. She was an only child. Very close to her parents, particularly her father. She and her father were both gifted poets. Lawrence told her to manufacture a quarrel with her parents and break off all contact with them. And she did. She did it because Lawrence instructed her to do it, and because Lawrence was the great magus, the great seer, who was about to guide us all into the next age of man. There was absolutely no advantage to him in cutting her off from her family. It didn't benefit him in the slightest. He did it because he could. He did it to cause anguish for her and her parents. He did it because he was cruel. Sylvia D'Agostino was one of the people who disappeared, I said. I don't know anything about that, said Ketterly. I don't think you can claim he was intellectually honest. He said he'd been to other worlds. He said other people had been there too. That's not exactly honest, is it? There may have been a slight edge of superciliousness in my voice, which I suppose I would have done better to suppress, but I've always liked winning arguments. Ketterly scowled. He seemed to struggle with something. He opened his mouth to say something, changed his mind, and then... I don't like you very much, he said. I laughed. I can live with that, I said. There was a silence. Why a labyrinth, do you suppose? I asked. What do you mean? Why do you think he described the other world, the one he said he went to most often, as a labyrinth? Ketterly shrugged. A vision of cosmic grandeur, I suppose. A symbol of the mingled glory and horror of existence. No one gets out alive. Okay, I said. But what I still don't quite understand was how he convinced you of its existence. The labyrinth world, I mean. He had us perform a ritual that was supposed to bring us there. There were aspects of the ritual that were evocative, I suppose, suggestive. A ritual, really. I thought Arne Sales's position was that rituals were nonsense. Didn't he say something like that in the half-seen door? That's right. He claimed that he personally was able to access the labyrinth world simply by making an adjustment to his frame of mind, by returning to a childlike state of wonder, a pre-rational consciousness. He claimed to be able to do this at will. Unsurprisingly, most of us, his students, got absolutely nowhere with this, so he created a ritual that we were to perform in order to access the labyrinth. But he made it clear that this was a concession to our lack of ability. I see. Most of you. What? You said most of you couldn't enter the labyrinth without the ritual, It seemed to imply that some of you could. A slight pause. Sylvia. Sylvia thought she could get there in the same way that Lawrence did. With this return to a state of wonder. She was a strange girl, as I've said. A poet. She lived very much inside her head. Who knows what she thought she saw. And did you ever see it? The labyrinth? He considered. Mostly I had what you might call intimations. A sense of standing in a huge space. Not just wide, but immensely tall, too. And this is quite hard to admit. But yes, I did see it once. I mean, I thought I saw it once. What did it look like? Very much like Lawrence's description. Like an infinite series of classical buildings knitted together. And what do you think it meant? I asked. Nothing. I don't think it meant anything at all. A short silence. Then he suddenly said, Does anyone know you're here? Sorry, I said. It seemed an odd question. You said that the Lawrence Arne Sayles connection dogged my career in academia. Yet here you are, an academic, asking questions about it all, dragging it all up again. I just wondered why you weren't being more careful. Aren't you afraid it will tarnish your brilliant career? I don't think anyone is going to take issue with my approach, I said. My book on Arne Sayles is part of a wider project on transgressive thinking, as I think I've already explained. Oh, I see, he said. So you've told lots of people that you were coming here today to see me. All your friends. I frowned. No, I haven't told anyone. I don't usually tell people what I'm doing, but that's not because... Interesting, he said. We looked at each other with a sort of mutual dislike. I was about to rise and go, when he suddenly said, Do you really want to understand Lawrence and the hold he had over us? Yes, I said. Of course. Then in that case, we should perform the ritual. The ritual, I said. Yes. The one to open the path to the labyrinth. Yes. What? Now? I was a bit startled by the suggestion. But I wasn't afraid. What was there to be afraid of? You still remember it, I said. Oh, yes. As I said, I have an excellent memory. Oh, well, I... Will it take long? I asked. Only I have to... It takes 12 minutes, he said. Oh, okay. Sure. Why not? I said. I stood up. I don't have to take any drugs, do I? I said. Because that's not really... He laughed that rather contemptuous laugh again. You've had a cup of coffee. I think that'll be sufficient. He lowered the blinds of the windows. He took a candle and a candlestick from the mantelpiece. The candlestick was an old-fashioned brass one with a square base. It didn't really match the rest of the furnishings in the house, which were modern, minimalist, European. He got me to stand in the sitting room, facing the door that led to the hall. This area had been left free from furniture. He picked up my messenger bag, the bag containing my journals, my index, and my pens, and placed it on my shoulder. What's that for? I asked, frowning. You're going to need your notebooks, he said. You know, when you get to the labyrinth. He had an odd sense of humour. Writing this, I feel a sort of terror descend on me. I know now what is coming. My hand is shaking, and I must stop writing for a moment to try to control it. But at the time, I felt nothing. No presentiment of danger. Nothing. He lit the candle and placed it on the floor of the hall, just beyond the door. The floor of the hall was the same as the floor of the sitting room, a solid wood flooring in oak. I noticed a blotch where he put the candlestick, as if the oak there had been repeatedly stained with candle wax, and within the dark stain was an unstained lighter square into which the candlestick base fitted precisely. "You need to focus on the candle," he said. So I did. But at the same time, I was thinking about that pale square in the dark patch and the candlestick fitting into it. And that was the point at which I realized that he was lying. The candle had stood in that precise spot many, many times, and he had performed this ritual over and over again. He still believed. He still thought he could reach the other world. I wasn't afraid, only incredulous and amused, and I started going over in my mind what questions I could ask him after the ritual in order to expose his dishonesty. He turned out the lights in the house. It was dark except for the candle burning on the floor and the orange haze from the street lights outside that penetrated the blinds. He stood slightly behind me and instructed me to keep my eyes upon the candle. Then he began to chant in a language I had never heard before. I surmised from the similarities to Welsh and Cornish that it was Brittonic. I think if I had not already found out his secret, I would have guessed it then. He chanted with conviction, with fervor, like he believed absolutely in what he was doing. I heard the name Adidomerus several times. "Close your eyes now," he said. I did so. More chanting. My amusement at discovering his secret sustained me for a while, but then I began to grow bored. He abandoned language altogether and seemed to drag out of himself a sort of animal growl that started in his stomach impossibly deep and grew higher, wilder, louder, more extraordinary. Everything switched. It was as if the world had somehow just stopped. He fell silent. The Berlioz was cut off mid-chorus. My eyelids were still closed, but I could tell that the quality of the darkness had changed. It was greyer, cooler. The air felt colder and much damper, as if we'd been plunged into a fog. I wondered if somewhere a door had been thrown open, but that made no sense, because at the same time, the hum of London ceased. There was a sound of vast emptiness, and all around me waves were hitting walls with a dull thud. I opened my eyes. The walls of a vast room rose up around me. Statues of minotaurs loomed over me, darkening the space with their bulk, their massive horns jutting into the empty air, their animal expressions solemn, inscrutable. I turned in utter incredulity. Ketterly was standing in his shirt sleeves. He was completely at his ease. He was looking at me and smiling as if I was an experiment that had gone surprisingly well. "Forgive me for not saying anything before now," he smiled. "But I really am delighted to see you. A young, healthy man is just what I wanted." "Put it back!" I screamed at him. He began to laugh. And he laughed, and laughed, and laughed.